and we actually did that. But at the actual wedding, what happened was, this young lady had done some public service work out in the outback, got to meet a fellow who was doing, who was a geologist and was working for various companies looking for potential mining sites. And when he got married, you know, to my niece, he went along like the head of his support group, who was a full-blown Aborigine, and he ended up sitting right next to me. We had a fascinating talk. And it turns out he travels the world going to conferences on maintaining the world's Aboriginal populations.
Oh, that's a great story. Well, I wish him a great deal of success. As far as minerals, you know, Australia has lots of minerals. One of the fascinating things, I don't know why, but black opal. There's a certain location in Australia that is famous for incredible high-quality black opal gems.
That I know absolutely nothing.
Well, we live in a time where no one can know everything, unfortunately. Supposedly about the 17th or 16th century was the last opportunity to be able to pull that off.
I have a totally different subject.
Okay.
This is actually relevant to the subject. Remember, I believe it was 2019 at Ham Radio University, I gave a talk on receivers from Spark, quadrature angle modulation, and I believe you were there and very taken with it.
Yes, indeed. It was a fine presentation.
I have an idea for the upcoming Finally Back Live Ham Radio University. On December 7th, I haven't finished it yet, but I've committed doing a presentation on crazy antennas for complicated systems. I'm wondering, it's about a month before HRU, I'm wondering if maybe a slightly reduced version of that might not be a good talk for HRU about very complicated antennas. No, not your usual stuff, what's the SWR or the Yagi or something like that. You know, with huge numbers of stacked phase arrays.
Yeah, I would think that it would be quite fascinating, personally. And matter of fact, you told me something that I didn't know. I was unaware that they're bringing it back live. I got the sense that they had found Zoom to be so cost-effective that so much for the live presentations. So they're going back to live presentations, or is it going to be a hybrid type of situation?
I received an email copy of the Weimar blog a day or two ago. I have to assume you did too. And there's a page on it in there.
WSUN.
Okay, I've been falling behind my email reading. So I have to pull that out and read it. Paul, was that you out there?
Yes. It is live this year, CW Post. And it's actually free, but then they request a $10 donation. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. I had some fun times there listening to Ed and doing the equipment calibration with good old Andy. That was fun. So it's a shame. I don't know if Larry's going to be doing a Fox Hunt presentation. That was Andy's other gig there. I assume there's not going to be any equipment calibration discussion, but I'm glad to hear that they're bringing back live. I think it lost something in virtual. I appreciate the ease of being a lazy good-for-nothing by operating virtually, but sometimes it's nice to actually see human beings.
Want to hear my take on that?
One more thing. They,
sure.
They announced that on amateur radio Newsline last week as well. So they're figuring a minimum of 300 people showing up. That's what they're hoping for.
Okay, good. I hope they get more people than they expect. Ed, you want to tell me something?
I didn't do the Zoom ones because I just felt it was hollow and didn't really appeal to me. You have to realize, many of the presentations at HRU are pretty much the same year to year, and if you go after a few years, it's kind of like watching repeats on television. But that's not really why I go there. I go to see, you know, something new and interesting, something a little different. It just schmooze. And without that, it just was no percentage to me. And while I have, let me also say, with my proposal to possibly doing something, possible I'm reaching too high, it would just be you and me who actually cares about such things.
I don't know. I find that it's a little too easy to underestimate people, and almost anything can be presented in such a way that different understanding, levels of understanding, can take away different bits and pieces. There's always going to be something a little too esoteric for some and too simple for others. But, you know, I mean, we've always had this kind of give and take about keeping it simple, and I don't like to keep it so simple that I start to feel as though I'm telling a fairy story instead of a science report. But, you know, I tend to think that if you do, and I'm sure you're capable of doing a presentation that's kind of, you know, doesn't kind of focus in on the esoteric, that I think a lot of people would enjoy it.
Comment?
What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, is it a similar kind of presentation you gave to the club recently? That was terrific.
That was based on an earlier presentation. That was basically the same presentation I was talking about that I gave at HRU in 2019. This one would be about very complicated antenna systems, elaborate, you know, things like solid-state steerable radar antennas. One thing I probably would finish up in is, you know, the central crème would be a Aegis radar system, and including some that I actually personally worked on myself.
No, that sounds very good. Very good. And, you know, it's all related to antennas. What ham would it like that?
At the heart, there are dipoles and verticals. It's just there's a whole lot of them.
HD, comment. Yeah. And I would say, in the wide span of people that can give a presentation that's above people's heads, yet bring it down and cover the swath of the different audience numbers, you are the high point that I've ever seen as being able to cover that swath. So my answer, based on limited input, is absolutely you can pull that off. Usually have present probably one of the worst examples of being able to do that. You're probably one of the best. I see no reason why you couldn't pull that off.
So much for the kind words.
You're most welcome.
Well, Ed, I think you've heard from us. I think you could do a great job. I hope you consider doing it. It's already 10:30, long time for Paul and the SpaceNet report, so I thank Jim and I thank Ed and all the other people who participated tonight. I do appreciate it. And now it's time for the SpaceNet report with Paul WS2N.
Had a number of doubles and overlaps there. Voice all over.
Okay, I just wanted to thank everyone, especially you, Ed, and Jim, and second the emotion, and I think it would be a very enjoyable presentation, and as Paul thinks and as Jim thinks. So I look forward to it. I hope they tape it or record it in some fashion for posterity's sake. And I thought it's now 10:31, and as good a time as any to get Paul in. I don't want him to wait too long. I'm sorry that I dragged it out another 15 minutes. So Thanks to everyone, and now the SpaceNet report with Paul, WS2N.
Thanks, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good. Yeah, okay, go through a couple of things that I wrote down here. There's a company called Intuitive Machines. Now, they are developing a lunar lander, and I talked about Intuitive Machines. Their lander is called Novus C. I've talked about them many times before on the net, and they were supposed to be launching on a Falcon 9 in roughly 2 weeks, but that now has been delayed. It's going to be delayed until January, and the reason for it is not technical, but it's there's only so many rockets that they could launch from a certain launch pad. They need Launch Complex 39A, particular mission. That is the complex that they use for space shuttles, and they use for Apollo 11. And now the Falcon 9 is launched from there, as well as the Falcon Heavy. That's one with the three Falcon 9s, the big one for, from SpaceX. The problem is they have to launch from that pad because up near the top they have a supply for liquid methane. The lander itself needs liquid methane. They need to load that up at the end, at the end of the countdown, before launch. So there's too many different rockets being launched from there. There's cargo missions. There's government launch by SpaceX. There's one right after the other. So they're getting pushed back until January. But it's going to be interesting to see Novus C eventually launch and land. It should take them about 7 days to get to actually landing. A few days to get into orbit, and then they'll eventually land. One thing I like about this particular mission, by the way, the thing weighs around almost 2,000 pounds, a little less than that. So it's right before it lands, maybe about 30, 40, or maybe about 100 feet off the ground, it's going to release a teeny tiny camera. It's going to float away. Now, the camera will float down to the surface, 1/6 gravity, so it's not just going to drop like a rock. It's going to drop slowly to the ground. But as it does, it's got multiple cameras on it. As it turns, it'll be taking pictures. And what they plan on doing is actually seeing the Novus C actually land on the surface of the moon. So because of that reason, I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be the first private company ever to actually land on the moon. It's done through a NASA contract that they got probably about 6 years ago, and now they're finally going to make good on it. They've developed the first launch vehicle, and they have two more planned as well after this one lands, every year. Probably the beginning of 2025, they'll launch another one, and another one after that. Then they're going to have regular contracts for NASA. They'll be able to eventually bring cargo, required cargo to the moon, and they plan on doing many, many launches in the future, as well as other companies. But this would be the first one, first private company to do it. And I was surprised to see that earlier in the year they became a public traded company that are actually on the NASDAQ. Anyway, hope they make it to the moon. I just wanted to talk about that because I thought they were going to be going up 2 weeks from now, and now I have to wait till January. On another topic, the Starliner update topic. That's another spacecraft I've talked about many, many times before. They've actually launched twice. The goal is to eventually launch crews on a regular basis to the International Space Station and eventually to other space stations, similar to what SpaceX has been doing for years now. SAR liner will be able to carry a crew of four. They're being built by Boeing, and they've had some problems in the past, which I've talked about before. They launched, they were supposed to go to the space station, they had computer problems, they had time-related problems between the spacecraft and what it was programmed originally. The time was off. All kinds of problems where spacecraft thought that it had to be firing its thruster engines to get itself to a certain altitude. And finally, NASA, you know, they shut it down from the ground and realized what was wrong. They had to bring it back, which was successful. It does land in New Mexico with airbags, so it actually lands on the ground. So it was successful. Naturally, no crew in it. That was the first try. The second try was successful. They got it off the ground and docked with the International Space Station, opened up the hatches, and eventually people from the space station got to go inside, poke around. And after a while, they sent that back, and that successfully landed on in the same place in New Mexico, in White Sands, New Mexico. But they've yet to put a crew on board. SpaceX has been doing it for years, and there was competition in the beginning, which one was going to be able to get to the space station first with the crew. And because of the problems with Starliner, crew Dragon won out. But now they plan on launching in April, and it would have been earlier. But again, the manifest that's being set up very busy now in all these launch facilities. They pushed them back to April, and this will actually have a crew on board. Butch Wilmore, NASA astronaut, and Sonny Williams, up there quite a few times. He's a very good spokesman for the astronaut corps and NASA. Hope to both of them successfully launching, docking with the space station, spending a couple of weeks up there, and then returning successfully to White Sands, New Mexico, with the big airbags that pop out. You know, they come through the atmosphere, heat shield, parachutes, and all that. But towards the very end, the big airbags open up and soften the landing. So we'll see. I believe that will be very successful. Boeing has poured a fortune into this. It was a set contract with NASA, you know, a certain amount of billions of dollars, $4 billion or something when they first made the deal. And the contract says if you're late or if there's any kind of problem, Boeing will be on their own. So they're very late by a couple of years, and Boeing has been pouring tons of money into this project, and that actually worked out for NASA. You know, although NASA would rather have another crew vehicle being able to go to the International Space Station. You always want redundancy. You don't want identical redundancy. You know, you want two different companies, two different spacecraft, two different something or others. Anytime you do something, and we'll see how this goes. Any comments? WS1. Okay. I just wanted to talk about this one vehicle that's kind of like stuck in space, called Varda. Varda is a company that wants to manufacture stuff in space. They actually succeeded at it. They paid SpaceX to launch them on a Falcon 9 rocket, sent them into orbit. And it was, successfully got into an equatorial orbit. They had a little manufacturing plant inside the spacecraft, and wanted to make some kind of crystal. And they can't make it on Earth. They need zero-G gravity to do it. And they know from the telemetry, everything worked out. You know, the thing's been in orbit since it was launched in June. And everything worked out great. About a month or two ago, they wanted to land, and they never got clearance from the FAA or from the Air Force. They wanted to land in the Utah desert, same desert that that meteorite that NASA brought back a week or two ago, a couple of weeks ago. That went out to the Bennu meteor or asteroid and brought back material on the OSIRIS-REx program that landed in the Utah desert. That's where this company, this private company, Varda, wants to land. They have a descent capsule, they have parachute, and eventually they want to duplicate what they did. But they never got the okay from the government. They just, I don't know what happened. They got the okay to launch. The manufacturing went well. And now their plan is to land this thing in the desert. Now, the reason for it is coordination with the government. It's not like they're, you know, manufacturing some kind of pharmaceutical on, you know, that's going to, you know, contaminate the earth when it gets back. But they needed the okay to do it. They still don't have it. So what they've done is they've contracted with Australia to eventually bring it back in the deserts of Australia, the outback, like we were talking about before. They didn't give up with the Air Force. They didn't give up with the FAA. So if they get the okay to land in the Utah desert, they will do that. But if that doesn't work, they're going to head to Australia. And they have future missions planned. And it looks like they're going to make Australia the landing zone for them in the future. I don't think they want to deal with the government in the Utah proving grounds. It's an area where it's off limits to people. You know, they have to be careful when they even go out there, because there's munitions. I mean, you know, there's stuff that could detonate when that's playing out there. They've been using this range for like 50, 60 years. And, that's probably the main reason that they are not giving them a license to land. But interesting. It's an ambitious program to eventually create things in space, manufacture things in space that can't be done here, without the space station. You know, this is all on their own. This is a free-flying satellite. We'll see how Varda does. Probably within a couple of weeks, they'll get the okay. My guess is to return to the Utah Test and Training Range, WS2S. That's not, they're going to be landing in, I think they said, Adelaide, near the Adelaide City. We'll see. Another rocket I've been following that hasn't taken off yet, but hopefully it will, is the Vulcan rocket that's being built by Boeing and Lockheed. Boeing and Lockheed together are called the ULA, United Launch Alliance, and they've been building like the Delta IV rocket. They've been building the Atlas V rocket. Well, those two rockets are being phased out and being replaced by this one rocket, Vulcan. And this thing has been delayed in its launch probably a year or so. But now they finally got a date, December 24th, Christmas Eve, this thing's going to go up, which I'm looking forward to seeing, because a lot of flights that NASA and other entities have planned to go up are going to be using Vulcan in the future. Vulcan uses a Centaur upper stage, a very powerful rocket that's being used, they're using B-4 engines by Blue Origin. Blue Origin is building the engines for them. And they're ready to go. They have the engines installed. This thing is complete. And they should launch on December 24th. Their first mission, it's ambitious. You know, it's not like SpaceX. SpaceX launches, their early rockets, one right after the other. If it crashes, who cares? We'll put up another one. Boeing and Lockheed don't do that. They want this thing to succeed from day one. and the payload that they're putting on is called the Peregrine Little Lander. So from day one, they're launching this thing to the moon, you know, and they hope to land this Peregrine Lander built by Astrobotic. Astrobotic is the company that makes it, and we'll see. It's a private company. They make it all the way to the moon and land successfully. I think they will. They put a lot into this project as well, similar to the Nova C lander. So it'll be the first time that Vulcan ever goes up. Again, this is a liquid methane, liquid oxygen vehicle. It'll be the first time into orbit with one. But methane is going to be used for many, many companies in the future. But nobody in the United States has successfully gotten to orbit with one yet. A couple of them have tried. This rocket company, Relativity, they launched earlier this year, and that didn't work out. They got close, but the second stage failed on them. But I think Vulcan is going to be the first one for the States to successfully make at least one orbit, and then they'll go through translunar injection and send Peregrine on the way to the moon. They eventually, this thing will eventually be launching crews too. So they'll be launching the Starliner I talked about earlier. In fact, their second mission after Peregrine is Dream Chaser cargo version, which will be sending cargo to the International Space Station. That will be early next year. Dream Chaser itself will eventually have a vehicle. We'll have a crew on board. That's their ultimate goal. But in the beginning, it's going to just have cargo, a lot of cargo, the most that anybody could possibly send up to the International Space Station. I think 12,000 pounds or more. So we'll see. I hope Vulcan makes it. I'll definitely be watching that. I'll be paying attention on Christmas Eve to see if Vulcan gets off the ground. Any comments? WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. And there is another cargo flight going to the International Space Station, CRS-29. That is SpaceX cargo Dragon vehicle. And I think I'm going to bring up all standard supplies, food, old material, stuff for seven crew members on the International Space Station, like they always do. One of the things they're bringing up is something called a Lumina. Lumina is the transceiver that will be installed on the International Space Station. It's one of these things that's going to be using infrared laser for communication. The idea is to transmit from the Earth up to, their goal is to get to the space station, but they're going to transmit from the Earth up to geosynchronous satellite that also has a Lumina-type transceiver on board that's located in geosynchronous orbit, 23,000 miles, above the States, and they'll transmit up to that, and that's going to retransmit back down to the space station, and the other way around as well. I think it will dramatically increase the amount of data that could travel back and forth. It could be 10 to 100 times more than what RF does. Hopefully this works. It's got this big long name. It's called Illumina T. And it's called the Integrated Laser Communications Relay Demonstration Low Earth Orbit User Modem and Amplifier Terminal. So anyways, it's big contraption that they're going to mount on the outside of the International Space Station. And once they get it, powered up, ready to go, and I'm running a test. Before I put a picture of the three transmitters, you don't see the transmitters, but what they plan on doing, you see the Earth transmitting up to the geosynchronous satellite and then back down to National Space Station, and the other way around as well. We'll see. You know, I know NASA's going to have a lot of written information about this when they successfully do it, and I really believe they will. Any comments? WS2S. Okay, nothing heard. NASA Lucy spacecraft. Talked about this before. I know it sounds like a repeat, but they launched back in October of 2021. Here we are, years later. And the goal of Lucy is to travel all the way to past the asteroid belt to Trojan asteroids. And they're located in the same orbit, same distance where Jupiter is located. Groups of Trojan asteroids that Lucy plans on visiting. It's going to take many, many years to still get there. But in the meantime, like a couple of days from now, on November 1st, they plan on passing the first asteroid called Thinkage, and they want to test all their equipment. You know, there's half a dozen instruments on board Lucy, and they want to make sure everything's working. So they're going to be passing this asteroid. This asteroid's roughly a half a mile in diameter. And, the idea is to try to check everything out. And they're going to wind up getting close-up pictures. They're going to get within 200 miles of the asteroid, take pictures, test all their equipment. And all that really takes place within an 8-minute time frame. Right now, it's kind of small, so all they know about it is it's really a point of light in the sky. And this will be their big success for NASA if they successfully do this. And there's another one 2 years from now that they're going to pass called the Donald Johnson asteroid. And they plan on doing the same thing with that. We'll see. I think it's going to get there around 2027. When I say there, Trojan asteroids. And then from there, eventually it'll loop back, all the way back past Earth and then keep going all the way out to the Jupiter orbit again, many, many years from now, 30s, and then it'll be taking data from other Trojan asteroids that are also out in the same area where Jupiter is. Actually, millions of miles in front of Jupiter, and the other group is millions of miles behind Jupiter. They float in this area called the Lagrange Point 4 and Lagrange Point 5 area. It's a very stable orbit. These things have been there, probably in the beginning of the solar system. So, there you go. That's the story on Lucy. Any comments? WS2M. No transmission, but no audio. Okay, following this one spacecraft is its telescope, the IXPE. I remember talking about this again, 2021 on the net, launched by a Falcon rocket. And it's basically an X-ray telescope. Only now it's getting
complete,
information back from it that they consider really new information. They took data from this particular supernova that went off in the year 1006, or they call it the 1006 supernova, and they got data from it, figured out polarization of the X-rays that are coming off of this, and the scientists are going to have a ball with this. But this thing is in a perfect elliptical orbit around, perfect circular orbit around the equator. They didn't want it to get, like normally they would launch it, and they wouldn't care if it was 20 degrees inclination. They did that, it would come too close to the, they call it the, South Atlantic Anomaly. South Atlantic Anomaly is located where it sounds like it's located, and it tends to bring the Van Allen belt in that area too, you know, too close to the Earth in that location, which would foul up this whole telescope. So when they launched a couple of years ago on Falcon 9, they put this actually into a perfectly equatorial orbit away from the South Atlantic anomaly. And it's apparently all worked out. And I'm looking at the time. We're 11 o'clock, so let me turn this thing back to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night. Usually the Bubnet is on at 8:30, not 8 o'clock. On these repeaters, Limar Clubnet. And all is always welcome, whether you're a member or not. You can check in. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N for the Space Net Report. For the TechNet, back to you, Roy.
Well, our revels now are done. AC2GS, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet Report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. Thank you for coming. Thank you for saying something. Once again, have a great week. We'll be back next Sunday at 8 p.m. to try and do it all over again. Before I leave, the usual quotes from Dick, K2RIW. He would often end the technical net by the suggestion to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. So please be kind to your family, your friends, and even your enemies. We're living through tough times, so be nice about it. And, as Epictetus kept on saying, it is impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open and try and learn new things. It's fun to learn new things, and it's always good to exercise your brain. If you don't exercise things, they waste away. So we wouldn't want you to waste away as far as your brain's concerned. So again, everyone, have a great week. Be well. Stay safe. And come back next Sunday at 8 when we'll do this all over again. And as usual, I'd like to leave this particular technical net with a refrain, Slava Ukraine. Be well. This is AC2GS, and I am clear.
Looks like your internet audio went away.
One sec. What do you mean it went away? It might have gone away from the echo link, and it didn't get away from the radio.
That is the echo link audio. What happened to the echo link connection for the B2BXO?
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2. W2.
Good morning. 1:55 a.m. Audi temperature 54 degrees.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2.
My Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2L repeater. W2L repeater.
Morning, 4:55 a.m. Temperature 50 degrees.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The 5:01 a.m. Temperature 50 degrees.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning, M. Temperature 50 degrees.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
7 a.m. Base temperature 50 degrees.
W2.
Thank you.
temperature 54 degrees.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2AV.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
KD2FIU mobile.
KD2FIU WV2MSB. Reaching you from Talk. How are you?
Sorry. Reaching you from Plainview. Probably old Bethpage Road in Plainview.
Yeah, okay, fine business. Well, I guess your weather's the same as ours. It's dreary, foggy, cold, and wet. Here at this locale today. And I'm actually not going to be heading back to the Bronx until I think the second week in November, if I remember correctly. Unless something pops up before then. I also just flipped over to the Middle Island repeater while you were talking, and actually the Selden sounds a little better over here. Probably because it's VHF and we're in the mountains. See you later. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're about 30-40% noise, but readable, and that's working out. Now, let's see, by the second week of November, where are we? We'll be looking at... oh, gosh. 40? With the clock set back? 435, 440, sunset?
Roger, roger. Okay, I'm on Middle Island now. It should sound a little bit better, I guess. I'm in the clear here. I'm no longer in the hills of the Sea Pocket. But, yeah. Yeah, so they keep talking about eliminating daylight time, which I don't think is going to help us in terms of it getting dark early, because that means we would stay on standard time and it would get dark early all year. Is that right, what I'm thinking?
The proposal that I had heard a year and a half to 2 years ago was the opposite. They want to get rid of standard time. And I don't agree with that. Because I don't want to see sunrise in the winter at 8:25 during December. KD2FIU mobile, I'm looking for a road.
Okay, yeah, I certainly would not be happy with. I can remember when I was just in college. It was President Reagan. Or maybe it was Nixon. Yeah, it was Nixon, I guess. Because of the Arab oil embargo, they set the clock back in order to save fuel. And that meant we were all walking to school in the morning in the dark. We could carry a flashlight away to school so that the cars could see when I was on the... I had my musical instrument in one arm and my book bag on my shoulder and my flashlight.
Did copy. You are more than 50% noise right now. I did copy, and I agree, and I do remember. I was working full-time in Manhattan already for 2 years, and it was a shock. I got to say 7-3. I'm at my destination, WV2MSB, KD2FYU, 7-3, Maury.
Okay, George. Have a good time. Stay safe. We'll catch you later. WP2MSB.